hand and an oval-shaped piece of dark turquoise held in place by snaking silver strands. I didn't have any jewelry, and it had been a long time since anyone had given me a present, except for the planet Venus. I tried on the ring. It was way too big for my finger, but I could wrap yarn around the band the way high school girls did when they wore their boyfriend's rings. I was afraid, however, that if I took the ring, Billy might start thinking that I had agreed to be his girlfriend. He'd tell the other kids, and if I said it wasn't true, he'd point to the ring. On the other hand, I figured, Mom would approve, since accepting it would make Billy feel good about himself. I decided to compromise. "I'll keep it," I said, "but I'm not going to wear it." Billy's smile spread across his face. "But don't think this means we're boyfriend and girlfriend," I said. "And don't think this means you can kiss me." I didn't tell anyone about the ring, not even Brian. I kept it in my pants pocket during the day, and at night, I hid it in the bottom of the cardboard box where I kept my clothes. But Billy Dill had to go shoot his mouth off about giving me the ring. He started telling the other kids things like how, as soon as I was old enough, me and him were going to get married. When I found out what he was saying, I knew accepting the ring had been a big mistake. I also knew I should return it, but I didn't. I meant to, and every morning I'd put it in my pocket with the intention of giving it back, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. That ring was too darned pretty. A few weeks later, I was playing hide-and-seek along the tracks with some of the neighborhood kids. I found the perfect hiding place, a small tool shed behind a clump of sagebrush that no one had hidden before. But just as the kid who was it was finishing counting, the door opened and someone else tried to get in. It was Billy Dill. He hadn't even been playing with us. "You can't hide with me," I hissed at him. "You're supposed to find your own place." "It's too late," he said. "He's almost done counting." Billy crawled inside. The shed was tiny, with barely enough room for one person to fit in crouched over. I wasn't about to say so, but being that close to Billy scared me. "It's too crowded," I whispered. "You gotta leave." "No," Billy said. "We can fit." He rearranged his legs so they were pressed up against mine. We were so close I could feel his breath on my face. "It's too crowded," I said again, "and you're breathing on me." He pretended not to hear me. "You know what they do in the Green Lantern, don't you?" he asked. I could hear the muffled shouts of the other kids being chased by the boy who was it. I wished I hadn't chosen such a good hiding place. "Sure," I said. "What?" "The women are nice to the men." "But what do they do?" He paused. "See, you don't know." "I do," I said. "Want me to tell you?" "I want you to find your own hiding place." "They start by kissing," he said. "Ever kissed anyone?" In the narrow rays of light that shot through the gaps in the sides of the shed, I could see the rings of dirt around his skinny neck. "Of course I have. Lots of times."
"Who?"
"My dad." "Your dad doesn't count." "Someone not in your family. And with your eyes closed." "It doesn't count unless your eyes are closed." I told Billy that was about the dumbest thing I'd ever heard. If your eyes were closed, you couldn't see who you were kissing. Billy said there was an awful lot about men and women I didn't know. He said some men stuck knives into women while they were kissing them, especially if the women were being mean and didn't want to be kissed. But he told me he'd never do that to me. He put his face up next to mine. "Close your eyes," he said. "No way," I said. Billy smushed his face up against mine, then grabbed my hair and made my head bend sideways and stuck his tongue in my mouth. It was slimy and disgusting, but when I tried to pull away, he pushed in toward me. The more I pulled, the more he pushed, until he was on top of me, and I felt his fingers tugging at my shorts. His other hand was unbuttoning his own pants. To stop him, I put my hand down there, and when I touched it, I knew what it was, even though I had never touched one before. I couldn't knee him in the groin like Dad had told me to if a guy jumped me, because my knees were outside his legs, so I bit him hard on the ear. It must have hurt because he yelled and hit me in the face. Blood started gushing out of my nose. The other kids heard the ruckus and came running. One of them opened the shed door and Billy and I scrambled out, pulling on our clothes. "I kissed Jeanette," Billy yelled. "Did not," I said. "He's a liar. We just got into a fight, that's all." He was a liar, I told myself all the rest of the day. I hadn't really kissed him, or at least it didn't count. My eyes had been open the entire time. The next day I took the ring to Billy Deal's house. I found him out back, sitting in an abandoned car. Its red paint had been bleached by the desert sun and then turned orange along the rusting trim. The tires had collapsed a long time ago, and the black rag roof was peeling. Billy was sitting in the driver's seat, making engine noises in his throat and pretending to work a phantom stick shift. I stood nearby, waiting for him to acknowledge me. He didn't, so I spoke first. "I don't want to be your friend," I said, "and I don't want your ring anymore." "I don't care," he said. "I don't want it either." He kept looking straight ahead through the cracked windshield. I reached through the open window, dropped the ring in his lap, and turned and walked away. I heard the clink and clunk of the car door opening and closing behind me. I kept walking. Then I felt a sharp sting on the back of my head as if a little rock had hit me. Billy had thrown the ring at me. I kept walking. "Guess what?" Billy shouted. "I raped you." I turned around and saw him standing there by the car, looking hurt and angry, but not as tall as usual. I searched my mind for a cutting comeback, but since I didn't know what rape meant, all I could think to say was, "Big deal." At home, I looked up the word in the dictionary. Then I looked up the words that explained it. And though I couldn't figure it out completely, I knew it wasn't good. Usually, when I didn't understand a word, I'd ask Dad about it, and we'd read over the definition together and discuss it. I didn't want to do that now. I had a hunch it would cause problems. The next day, Lori, Brian, and I were sitting at one of the spool tables in the depot, playing five-card draw and keeping an eye on Maureen, while Mom and Dad spent some time downtown at the Owl Club. We heard Billy Deal outside, calling my name. Lori looked at me, and I shook my head. We went back to our card game, but Billy kept on, so Lori went out on the porch, which was the old platform where people used to board the train, and told Billy to go away. She came back in and said, "He's got a gun." Lori picked up Maureen. One of the windows shattered, and then Billy appeared framed in it. He used the butt of his rifle to knock out the remaining pieces of glass, then pointed the barrel inside. "It's just a BB gun," Brian said. "I told you you'd be sorry," Billy said to me, and then pulled the trigger. It felt like a wasp had stung me in the ribs. Billy started firing at us all, working the pump action quickly back and forth before each shot. Brian pushed over the spool table, and we all crouched behind it. The BBs pinged off the tabletop. Maureen was howling. I turned to Lori, who was the oldest and in charge. She was biting her lower lip, thinking. She handed Maureen to me and took off running across the room. Billy got her once or twice. Brian stood up to try to draw the fire, but she made it upstairs to the second floor. Then she came down again. She had Dad's pistol, and she pointed it dead at Billy. "That's just a toy," Billy said, but his voice was a little shaky. "It's real, all right," I shouted. "It's my dad's gun." If it is, he said, she ain't got the cojones to use it. Try me, Lori told him. Go on, then, Billy said. Shoot me and see what happens. Lori wasn't as good a shot as me, but she pointed the gun in Billy's general direction and pulled the trigger. I squeezed my eyes at the explosion, and when I opened them, Billy had disappeared. We all ran outside wondering if Billy's blood-soaked body would be lying on the ground, but he had ducked under the window. When he saw us, he hightailed it down the street along the tracks. He got about 50 yards away and started shooting at us again with his BB gun. I yanked the pistol out of Lori's hand, aimed low, and pulled the trigger. I was too carried away to hold the gun the way Dad had taught me, and the recoil nearly pulled my shoulder out of its socket. The dirt kicked up a few feet in front of Billy. He jumped what seemed about 3 feet up in the air and broke into a dead run down the tracks. We all started laughing, but it seemed funny only for a second or two, and then we stood there looking at one another in silence. I realized my hand was shaking so bad I could hardly hold the gun. A little while later, a squad car pulled up outside the depot and Mom and Dad got out. Their faces were grave. An officer got out also and walked alongside them to the door. We kids were all sitting inside on the benches wearing polite, respectful expressions. The officer looked at each of us individually, as if counting us. I clasped my hands in my lap to show I was well-behaved. Dad squatted in front of us, one knee to the floor, his arms folded across the other knee, cowboy style. "So what happened here?" he asked. "It was self-defense," I piped up. Dad had always said that self-defense was a justifiable reason for shooting someone. "I see," Dad said. The policeman told us that some of the neighbors had reported seeing kids shooting guns at each other, and he wanted to know what had happened. We tried to explain that Billy had started it, that we'd been provoked and were defending ourselves and didn't even aim to kill. But the cop wasn't interested in the nuances of the situation. He told Dad that the whole family would need to come down to the courthouse the next morning and see the magistrate. Billy Dill and his dad would be there, too. The magistrate would get to the bottom of the matter and decide what measures needed to be taken. "Are we going to be sent away?" Brian asked the officer. "That's up to the magistrate," he said. That night, Mom and Dad spent a long time upstairs talking in low voices while we kids lay in our boxes. Finally, late in the evening, they came down, their faces still grave. "We're going to Phoenix," Dad said. "When?" I asked. "Tonight." Dad allowed each of us to bring only one thing. I ran outside with a paper bag to gather up my favorite rocks. When I returned, holding the heavy bag at the bottom so it wouldn't split, Dad and Brian were arguing over the plastic jack-o'-lantern filled with green plastic army soldiers that Brian wanted to bring. "You're bringing toys?" Dad asked. "You said I could take one thing, and this is my thing," Brian said. "This is my one thing," I said, holding up the bag. Lori, who was bringing the Wizard of Oz, objected, saying that a rock collection wasn't one thing, but several things. It would be like her bringing her entire book collection. I pointed out that Brian's army soldiers were a collection. "And anyway, it's not the entire rock collection, just the best ones." Dad, who usually liked debates on questions such as whether a bag of things is one thing, was not in the mood and told me the rocks were too heavy. "You can bring one," he said. "There are plenty of rocks in Phoenix," Mom added. I picked out a single geode, its insides coated with tiny white crystals, and held it in both hands. As we pulled out, I looked through the rear window for one last glimpse of the depot. Dad had left the upstairs light on, and the small window glowed. I thought of all those other families of miners and prospectors who had come to Battle Mountain hoping to find gold, and who had to leave town like us when their luck ran out. Dad said he didn't believe in luck, but I did. We'd had a streak of it in Battle Mountain. and I wished it had held. We passed the Green Lantern, with the Christmas lights twinkling over its door, and the Owl Club, with the winking neon owl in a chef's hat. And then we were out in the desert, the lights of Battle Mountain disappearing behind us. In the pitch-black night, there was nothing to look at but the road ahead, lit by the car's headlights. Grandma Smith's big white house had green shutters and was surrounded by eucalyptus trees. Inside were tall French doors and Persian carpets, and a huge grand piano that would practically dance whenever Grandma played her honky-tonk music. Whenever we stayed with Grandma Smith, she brought me into her bedroom and set me down at the vanity table, which was covered with little pastel-colored bottles of perfumes and powders. While I opened the bottles and sniffed them, she'd try to run her long metal comb through my hair, cursing out of the corner of her mouth because it was so tangled. "Doesn't that goddamn lazy-ass mother of yours ever comb your hair?" she once said. I explained that Mom believed children should be responsible for their own grooming. Grandma told me my hair was too long anyway. She put a bowl on my head, cut off all the hair beneath it, and told me I looked like a flapper. That was what Grandma used to be, but after she had her two children, Mom and our Uncle Jim, she became a teacher because she didn't trust anyone else to educate them. She taught in a one-room schoolhouse in a town called Yampai. Mom hated being the teacher's daughter. She also hated the way her mother constantly corrected her both at home and at school. Grandma Smith had strong opinions about the way things ought to be done. How to dress, how to talk, how to organize your time, how to cook and keep house, how to manage your finances. And she and Mom fought each other from the beginning. Mom felt that Grandma Smith nagged and badgered, setting rules and punishments for breaking the rules. It drove Mom crazy, and it was the reason she never set rules for us. But I loved Grandma Smith. She was a tall, leathery, broad-shouldered woman with green eyes and a strong jaw. She told me I was her favorite grandchild, and that I was going to grow up to be something special. I even liked all of her rules. I liked how she woke us up every morning at dawn, shouting, "Rise and shine, everybody," and insisted we wash our hands and comb our hair before eating breakfast. She made us hot cream of wheat with real butter. Then she oversaw us while we cleared the table and washed the dishes. Afterward, she took us all to buy new clothes and would go to a movie like Mary Poppins. Now, on the way to Phoenix, I stood up in the back of the car and leaned over the front seat between Mom and Dad. "Are we going to stay with Grandma?" I asked. "No," Mom said. She looked out the window, but not at anything in particular. Then she said, "Grandma's dead." "What?" I asked. I'd heard her, but I was so thrown I felt like I hadn't. Mom repeated herself, still looking out the window. I glanced back at Lori and Brian, but they were sleeping. Dad was smoking, his eyes on the road. I couldn't believe I'd been sitting there thinking of Grandma Smith, looking forward to eating cream of wheat and having her comb my hair and cuss. And all along, she'd been dead. I started hitting Mom on the shoulder hard and asking why she hadn't told us. Finally, Dad held down my fist with his free hand, the other holding both his cigarette and the steering wheel, and said, "That's enough, Mountain Goat." Mom seemed surprised that I was so upset. "Why didn't you tell us?" I asked. "There didn't seem any point," she said. "What happened?" Grandma had been only in her 60s, and most people in her family lived until they were about 100. The doctor said she died from leukemia, but Mom thought it was radioactive poisoning. The government was always testing nuclear bombs in the desert near the ranch, Mom said. She and Jim used to go out with a Geiger counter and find rocks that ticked. They stored them in the basement and used some to make jewelry for Grandma. "There's no reason to grieve," Mom said. "We've all got to go someday." And Grandma had a life that was longer and fuller than most. She paused. And now we have a place to live. Mom explained that Grandma Smith had owned two houses, the one she lived in with the green shutters and French doors, and an older house made of adobe in downtown Phoenix. Since Mom was the older of the two children, Grandma Smith had asked her which house she wanted to inherit. The house with the green shutters was more valuable, but Mom had chosen the adobe house. It was near Phoenix's business district, which made it a perfect place for Mom to start an art studio. She'd also inherited some money, so she could give up teaching and buy all the art supplies she wanted. She'd been thinking we should move to Phoenix ever since Grandma died a few months back, but Dad had refused to leave Battle Mountain because he was so close to a breakthrough in his cyanide leaching process. And I was, Dad said. Mom gave a snort of a laugh. So the trouble you kids got into with Billy Deal was actually a blessing in disguise, she said. My art career is going to flourish in Phoenix. I can just feel it. She turned around to look at me. We're off to another adventure, Geneticans. Isn't this wonderful? Mom's eyes were bright. I'm such an excitement addict. When we pulled in front of the house on North 3rd Street, I could not believe we were actually going to live there. It was a mansion, practically, so big that Grandma Smith had had two families living in it, both paying her rent. We had the entire place to ourselves. Mom said it had been built almost 100 years ago as a fort. The outside walls, covered with white stucco, were 3 feet thick. These sure would stop any Indians' arrows, I said to Brian. We kids ran through the house and counted 14 rooms, including the kitchens and bathrooms. They were filled with the things Mom had inherited from Grandma Smith. A dark Spanish dining table with 8 matching chairs, a hand-carved upright piano, sideboards with antique silver serving sets, and glass-fronted cabinets filled with Grandma's bone china, which Mom demonstrated was the finest quality by holding a plate up to the light and showing us the clear silhouette of her hand through it. The front yard had a palm tree, and the backyard had orange trees that grew real oranges. We'd never lived in a house with trees. I particularly loved the palm tree, which made me think I had arrived at some kind of oasis. There were also hollyhocks and oleander bushes with pink and white flowers. Behind the yard was a shed as big as some of the houses we lived in, and next to the shed was a parking space big enough for 2 cars. We were definitely moving up in the world. The people living on North 3rd Street were mostly Mexican and Indians who had moved into the neighborhood after the whites left for the suburbs and subdivided the big old houses into apartments. There seemed to be a couple of dozen people in each house. Men drinking beers from paper bags, young mothers nursing babies, old ladies sunning themselves on the sagging, weathered porches, and hordes of kids. All the kids around North 3rd Street went to the Catholic school at St. Mary's Church, about 5 blocks away. Mom, however, said nuns were killjoys who took the fun out of religion. She wanted us to go to a public school called Emerson. Although we lived outside the district, Mom begged and cajoled the principal until he allowed us to enroll. We were not on the bus route, and it was a bit of a hike to the school, but none of us minded the walk. Emerson was in a fancy neighborhood with streets canopied by eucalyptus trees, and the school building looked like a Spanish hacienda with a red terracotta roof. It was surrounded by palm trees and banana trees, and when the bananas ripened, the students all got free bananas at lunch. The playground at Emerson was covered with lush green grass watered by a sprinkler system, and it had more equipment than I'd ever seen. Seesaws, swings, a merry-go-round, a jungle gym, tetherballs, and a running track. Miss Shaw, the teacher in the 3rd grade class I was assigned to, had steely gray hair and pointy-rimmed glasses and a stern mouth. When I told her I read all the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, she raised her eyebrows skeptically. But after I read aloud from one of them, she moved me into a reading group for gifted children. Lori's and Brian's teacher also put them in gifted reading groups. Brian hated it because the other kids were older and he was the littlest guy in the class. But Lori and I were secretly thrilled to be called special. Instead of letting on that we felt that way, however, we made light of it. When we told Mom and Dad about our reading groups, we paused before the word gifted, clasping our hands beneath our chins, fluttering our eyelids, and pretending to look angelic. "Don't make a mockery of it," Dad said. "Of course you're special. Haven't I always told you that?" Brian gave Dad a sideways look. "If we're so special," he said slowly, "why don't you..." His words petered out. "What?" Dad asked. "What?" Brian shook his head. "Nothing," he said. Emerson had its very own nurse who gave the three of us ear and eye exams, our first ever. I aced the tests. "Eagle eyes and elephant ears," the nurse said. But Lori struggled trying to read the eye chart. The nurse declared her severely short-sighted and sent Mom a note saying she needed glasses. "No siree," Mom said. She didn't approve of glasses. If you had weak eyes, Mom believed, they needed to be exercised to get strong. The way she saw it, glasses were like crutches. They prevented people with feeble eyes from learning to see the world on their own. She said people had been trying to get her to wear glasses for years, and she had refused. But the nurse sent another note saying Lori couldn't attend Emerson unless she wore glasses, and the school would pay for them, so Mom gave in. When the glasses were ready, we all went down to the optometrist. The lenses were so thick they made Lori's eyes look big and bugged out, like fish eyes. She kept swiveling her head around and up and down. "What's the matter?" I asked. Instead of answering, Lori ran outside. I followed her. She was standing in the parking lot, gazing in awe at the trees, the houses, and the office buildings behind them. "You see that tree over there?" she said, pointing out a sycamore about 100 feet away. I nodded. "I cannot only see that tree. I can see the individual leaves on it." She looked at me triumphantly. "Can you see them?" I nodded. She didn't seem to believe me. "The individual leaves? I mean, not just the branches, but each little leaf?" I nodded. Lori looked at me and then burst into tears. On the way home, she kept seeing for the first time all these things that most everyone else had stopped noticing because they'd seen them every day. She read street signs and billboards aloud. She pointed out starlings perched on the telephone wires. We went into a bank, and she stared up at the vaulted ceiling and described the octagonal patterns. At home, Lori insisted that I try on her glasses. "They would blur my vision as much as they corrected hers," she said, "so I'd be able to see things as she always had." I put on the glasses and the world dissolved into fuzzy, blotchy shapes. I took a few steps and banged my shin on the coffee table. And then I realized why Lori didn't like to go exploring as much as Brian and I did. She couldn't see. Lori wanted Mom to try on the glasses, too. Mom slipped them on and, blinking, looked around the room. She studied one of her own paintings quietly, then handed the glasses back to Lori. "Did you see better?" I asked. "I wouldn't say better," Mom answered. "I'd say different. Maybe you should get a pair, Mom. I like the world just fine the way I see it," she said. But Lori loved seeing the world clearly. She started compulsively drawing and painting all the wondrous things she was discovering, like the way each curved tile on Emerson's roof cast its own curved shadow on the tile below, and the way the setting sun painted the underbellies of the clouds pink, but left the piled-up tops purple. Not long after Lori got her glasses, she decided she wanted to be an artist, like Mom. As soon as we'd settled into the house, Mom threw herself into her art career. She erected a big white sign on the front yard on which she had carefully painted, in black letters with gold outlines, R.M. Walls Art Studio. She turned the two front rooms of the house into a studio and gallery, and she used two bedrooms in the back to warehouse her collected works. An art supply store was three blocks away, on North First Street. And thanks to Mom's inheritance, we were able to make regular shopping expeditions to the store, bringing home rolls of canvas that Dad stretched and stapled onto wooden frames. We also brought back oil paints, watercolors, acrylics, gesso, a silk screening frame, India ink, paintbrushes and pen nibs, charcoal pencils, pastels, fancy rag paper for pastel drawings, and even a wooden mannequin with movable joints, whom we named Edward and who, Mom said, would pose for her when we kids were off at school. Mom decided that before she could get down to any serious painting, she needed to compile a thorough art reference library. She bought dozens of big loose-leaf binders and lots of packs of lined paper. Every subject was given its own binder. Dogs, cats, horses, farm animals, woodland animals, flowers, fruits and vegetables, rural landscapes, urban landscapes, men's faces, women's faces, men's bodies, women's bodies, and hands, feet, bottoms, and other miscellaneous body parts. We spent hours and hours going through old magazines, looking for interesting pictures, and when we spotted one we thought might be a worthy subject of a painting, we held it up to Mom for approval. She studied it for a second and okayed or nixed it. If the photo made the grade, we cut it out, glued it on a piece of lined paper, and reinforced the holes in the paper with adhesive O's so the page wouldn't tear out. Then we got the appropriate three-ringed binder, added the new photograph, and snapped the ring shut. In exchange for our help on her reference library, Mom gave us all art lessons. Mom was also hard at work on her writing. She bought several typewriters, manuals and electrics, so she'd have backups should her favorite break down. She kept them in her studio. She never sold anything she wrote, but from time to time she received an encouraging rejection letter, and she thumbtacked those to the wall. When we kids came home from school, she'd usually be in her studio working. If it was quiet, she was painting or contemplating potential subjects. If the typewriter keys were clattering away, she was at work on one of her novels, poems, plays, short stories, or her illustrated collection of pithy sayings. One was, "Life is a bowl of cherries, with a few nuts thrown in," which she had titled R.M. Walls' Philosophy of Life. Dad joined the local electricians' union. Phoenix was booming, and he landed a job pretty quickly. He left the house in the morning wearing a yellow hard hat and big steel-toed boots, which I thought made him look extra handsome. Because of the union, he was making steadier money than we'd ever seen. On his first payday, he came home and called us all into the living room. "We kids had left our toys out in the yard," he declared. "No, sir, we didn't," I said. "I think you did," he said. "Go out and take a look." We ran to the front door. Outside in the yard, parked in a row, were three brand new bicycles, a big red one and two smaller ones, a blue boy's bike and a purple girl's bike. I thought at first that some of their kids must have left them there. When Lori pointed out that Dad had obviously bought them for us, I didn't believe her. We had never had bicycles. We'd learned to ride on other kids' bikes, and it never occurred to me that one day I might actually own one myself, especially a new one. I turned around. Dad was standing in the doorway with his arms crossed and a sly grin on his face. "Those bikes aren't for us, are they?" I asked. "Well, they're too damn small for your mother and me," he said. Lori and Brian had climbed on their bikes and were riding up and down the sidewalk. I stared at mine. It was shiny and purple and had a white banana seat, wire baskets on the side, chrome handlebars that swept out like steer horns, and white plastic handles with purple and silver tassels. Dad knelt beside me. "Like it?" he asked. I nodded. "You know, Mountain Goat, I still feel bad about making you leave your rock collection back in Battle Mountain," he said. "But we had to travel light." "I know," I said. "It was more than one thing, anyway." "I'm not so sure," Dad said. "Every damn thing in the universe can be broken down into smaller things. Even atoms, even protons. So theoretically speaking, I guess you had a winning case. A collection of things should be considered one thing. Unfortunately, theory don't always carry the day." We rode our bicycles everywhere. Sometimes we attached playing cards to the forks with clothespins, and they flapped against the spokes when the wheels turned. Now that Lori could see, she was the navigator. She got a city map from a gas station and plotted out our routes in advance. We pedaled past the Westward Ho Hotel, down Central Avenue where square-faced Indian women sold beaded necklaces and moccasins on rainbow-colored serapes they'd spread on the sidewalk. We pedaled to Woolworth's, which was bigger than all the stores in Battle Mountain put together, and played tag in the aisles until the manager chased us out. We got Grandma Smith's old wooden tennis rackets and pedaled off to Phoenix University, where we tried to play tennis with the dead balls other people had left behind. We pedaled to the Civic Center, which had a library where librarians recognized us because we were there so much. They helped us find books they thought we'd like, and we filled up the wire baskets on our bicycles and pedaled home right down the middle of the sidewalk, as if we owned the place. Since Mom and Dad had all this money, we got our own telephone. We had never owned a telephone before, and when it rang, we kids all scrambled for it. Whoever got there first summed up a super snooty English accent.
"Wall's residence, the butler speaking. May I help you?"
While the rest of us cracked up. We also had a big record player in a wooden cabinet that had been Grandma's. You could put a stack of records on it, and when one was finished playing, the needle arm automatically swung out and the next record dropped down with a happy slap. Mom and Dad loved music, especially rousing stuff that made you want to get up and dance, or at least sway your head or tap your foot. Mom was always going to thrift stores and coming back with old albums of polka music, Negro spirituals, German marching bands, Italian operas, and cattle roundup songs. She also bought boxes of used high heels that she called her dancing shoes. She'd slip on a pair of dancing shoes, put a stack of records on the phonograph, and crank the volume way up. Dad danced with her if he was there. Otherwise, she'd dance alone, waltzing or jitterbugging or doing the Texas two-step from room to room, the house filled with the sounds of Mario Lanza or oompa-ing tubas or some mournful cowboy singing "The Streets of Laredo." Mom and Dad also bought an electric washing machine that we kept out on the patio. It was a white enamel tub, up on legs, and we filled it with water from the garden hose. A big agitator swished back and forth, making the entire machine dance around on the cement patio. It had no cycles, so you waited until the water got dirty, then put the clothes through the wringer, two rubber rolling pins rigged above the tub that were turned by a motor. To rinse the clothes, you'd repeat the process without soap, then let the water drain into the yard to help the grass grow. Despite our wondrous appliances, life in Phoenix wasn't total luxury. We had about a gazillion cockroaches, big, strong things with shiny wings. We had just a few at first, but since Mom was not exactly a compulsive cleaner, they multiplied. After a while, entire armies were scuttling across the walls and floors and the kitchen counters. In Battle Mountain, we'd had lizards to eat the flies and cats to eat the lizards. We couldn't think of any animal that liked to eat roaches, so I suggested we buy roach spray, like all our neighbors did. But Mom was opposed to chemical warfare. It was like those Shell No Pest strips, she said. We'd end up poisoning ourselves, too. Mom decided hand-to-hand combat was the best tactic. We conducted roach massacres in the kitchen at night, because that was when they came out in force. We armed ourselves with rolled-up magazines or shoes. Even though I was only 9, I already wore size 10 shoes that Brian called roach killers and sneaked into the kitchen. Mom threw the light switch, and we kids all started the assault. You didn't even have to aim. We had so many roaches that if you hit any flat surface, you were sure to take out at least a few. The house also had termites. We discovered this a few months after we moved in, when Lori's foot crashed through the spongy wood floor in the living room. After inspecting the house, Dad decided that the termite infestation was so severe nothing could be done about it. We'd have to coexist with the critters. So we walked around the hole in the living room floor. But the wood was chewed through everywhere. We kept stepping on soft spots in the floorboards, crashing through and creating new holes. "Damned if this floor isn't starting to look like a piece of Swiss cheese," Dad said one day. He told me to fetch him his wire cutters, a hammer, and some roofing nails. He finished off the beer he was drinking, snipped the can open with his wire cutters, hammered it flat, and nailed it over the hole. He needed more patches, he said, so he had to go out and buy another 6-pack. After he polished off each beer, he used the can to repair one of the holes. And whenever a new hole appeared, he'd just get out his hammer, down a beer, and do another patch job. A lot of our neighbors on North 3rd Street were kind of weird. A clan of gypsies lived down the block in a big falling-apart house with plywood nailed over the porch to create more indoor space. They were always stealing our stuff. And one time, after Brian's pogo stick had disappeared, he saw one of the old gypsy women bouncing down the sidewalk on it. She wouldn't give it back, so Mom got into a big argument with the head of the clan, and the next day we found a chicken with its throat cut on our doorstep. It was some kind of gypsy hex. Mom decided, as she put it, to fight magic with magic. She took a ham bone out of the beans and went down to the gypsy's house, waving it in the air. Standing on the sidewalk, she held up the bone like a crucifix at an exorcism and called down a curse on the entire gypsy clan in their house, vowing it would collapse with a lot of them in it, and the bowels of the earth would open and swallow them forever if they bothered us again. The next morning, Brian's pogo stick was lying in the front yard. The neighborhood also had its share of perverts. Mostly they were shabby, hunched men with wheedling voices who hung around on street corners and followed us to and from school, trying to give us boosts when we climbed a fence, offering us candy and loose change if we'd go play with them. We called them creeps and hollered at them to leave us alone. But I worried about hurting their feelings because I couldn't help wondering if maybe they were telling the truth, that all they wanted was to be our friends. At night, Mom and Dad always left the front door and the back door and all the windows open. Since we had no air conditioning, they explained, we needed to let the air circulate. From time to time, a vagrant or wino would wander through the front door, assuming the house was deserted. When we woke up in the morning, we'd find one asleep in a front room. As soon as we roused them, they shambled off apologetically. Mom always assured us they were just harmless drunks. Maureen, who was 4 and had a terrible fear of boogeymen, kept dreaming that intruders in Halloween masks were coming through the open doors to get us. One night, when I was almost 10, I was awakened by someone running his hands over my private parts. At first, it was confusing. Lori and I slept in the same bed, and I thought maybe she was moving in her sleep. I groggily pushed the hand away. "I just want to play a game with you," a man's voice said. I recognized the voice. It belonged to a scraggly guy with sunken cheeks who'd been hanging around North 3rd Street recently. He'd tried to walk us home from school and had given Brian a magazine called Kids on a Farm, with pictures of boys and girls wearing only underpants. "Pervert!" I yelled and kicked at the man's hand. Brian came running into the room with a hatchet he kept by his bed, and the man bolted out the door. Dad was out that night, and when Mom slept, she was dead to the world. So Brian and I ran after the man ourselves. As we got to the sidewalk, lit by the purplish glow from the streetlights, he disappeared around the corner. We searched for him for a few blocks, Brian whacking at the bushes with his hatchet, but we couldn't find him. On the way home, we were slapping each other's hands and pumping our fists in the air as if we'd won a boxing match. We decided we had been pervert hunting, which was just like demon hunting, except the enemy was real and dangerous instead of being the product of a kid's overactive imagination. The next day, when Dad came home and we told him what had happened, he said he was going to kill that lowlife son of a bitch. He and Brian and I went on a serious pervert hunt. Our blood up, we searched the street for hours, but we never did find the guy. I asked Mom and Dad if we should close the doors and windows when we went to sleep. They wouldn't consider it. We needed the fresh air, they said, and it was essential that we refused to surrender to fear. So the windows stayed open. Maureen kept having nightmares of men in Halloween masks. And every now and then, when Brian and I were feeling revved up, he'd get a machete and I'd get a baseball bat and we'd go pervert hunting, clearing the streets of the creeps who preyed on kids. Mom and Dad like to make a big point about never surrendering to fear, or to prejudice, or the narrow-minded conformist stick-in-the-muds who try to tell everyone else what was proper. We were supposed to ignore those benighted sheep, as Dad called them. One day Mom went with us kids to the library at the Civic Center. Since the weather was sweltering, she suggested we cool off by jumping into the fountain in front of the building. The water was too shallow to swim in, but we paddled around pretending to be crocodiles until we attracted a small crowd of people who kept insisting to Mom that swimming was forbidden in the fountain. "Mind your own beeswax," Mom replied. I was feeling kind of embarrassed and started to climb out. "Ignore the fuddy-duddies," Mom told me. And to make it clear she paid no never mind to such people or their opinions, she clambered into the fountain and plopped down beside us, sending gallons of water sloshing over the sides. It never bothered Mom if people turned and stared at her, even in church. Although she thought nuns were killjoys and she didn't follow all the church's rules word for word, she treated the Ten Commandments more like the Ten Suggestions. Mom considered herself a devout Catholic and took us to Mass most Sundays. St. Mary's was the biggest, most beautiful church I had ever seen. It was made of sand-colored adobe and had two soaring steeples, a gigantic circular stained glass window, and leading up to the two main doors, a pair of sweeping staircases covered with pigeons. The other mothers dressed up for Mass, wearing black lace mantillas on their head and clutching green or red or yellow handbags that matched their shoes. Mom thought it was superficial to worry about how you looked. She said God thought the same way, so she'd go to church in torn or paint-splattered clothes. It was your inner spirit and not your outward appearance that mattered, she said. And come hymn time, she showed the whole congregation her spirit, belting out the words in such a powerful voice that people in the pews in front of us would turn around and stare. Church was particularly excruciating when Dad came along. Dad had been raised a Baptist, but he didn't like religion and didn't believe in God. He believed in science and reason, he said, not superstition and voodoo. But Mom had refused to have children unless Dad agreed to raise them as Catholics and to attend church himself on holy days of obligation. Dad sat in the pew fuming and shifting around and trying to bite his tongue while the priest carried on about Jesus resurrecting Lazarus from the dead, and the communicants filed up to eat the body and drink the blood of Christ. Finally, when Dad was unable to stand it any longer, He'd shout out something to challenge the priest. He didn't do it to be hostile. He hollered out his point in a friendly tone. "Yo, padre," he'd say. The priest usually ignored Dad and tried to go on with his sermon, but Dad persisted. He challenged the priest about the scientific impossibility of the miracles. And when the priest continued to ignore him, he'd get mad and yell out something about Pope Alexander the Sixth Bastard Children, or Pope Leo the Tenth's hedonism, or Pope Nicholas the Third's simony, or the murders committed in the name of the church during the Spanish Inquisition. "But what could you expect," he'd say, "from an institution run by celibate men who wore dresses?" At that point, the ushers would tell us we'd have to leave. "Don't worry, God understands," Mom said. "He knows that your father is a cross we must bear." City life was getting to Dad. "I'm starting to feel like a rat in a maze," he told me. He hated the way everything in Phoenix was so organized, with time cards, bank accounts, telephone bills, parking meters, tax forms, alarm clocks, PTA meetings, and pollsters knocking on the door and prying into your affairs. He hated all the people who lived in air-conditioned houses with windows permanently sealed and drove air-conditioned cars to 9-to-5 jobs in air-conditioned office buildings that he said were little more than gussied-up prisons. Just the sight of those people on their way to work made him feel hemmed in and itchy. He began complaining that we were all getting too soft, too dependent on creature comforts, and that we were losing touch with the natural order of the world. Dad missed the wilderness. He needed to be roaming free in open country and living among untamed animals. He felt it was good for your soul to have buzzards and coyotes and snakes around. That was the way man was meant to live, he'd say, in harmony with the wild, like the Indians, not this lords of the earth crap, trying to rule the entire goddamn planet, cutting down all the forests and killing every creature you couldn't bring to heel. One day we heard on the radio the woman in the suburbs had seen a mountain lion behind her house and called the police, who shot the animal. Dad got so angry he put his fist through a wall. "That mountain lion had as much right to his life as that sour old biddy does to hers," he said. "You can't kill something just because it's wild." Dad stewed for a while, sucking on a beer, and then he told us all to get in the car. "Where are we going?" I asked. We hadn't been on a single expedition since we moved to Phoenix. I missed them. "I'm going to show you," he said, "that no animal, no matter how big or wild, is dangerous as long as you know what you're doing." We all piled into the car. Dad drove, nursing another beer and cussing under his breath about that innocent mountain lion and that chicken shit suburbanite. We turned in at the city zoo. None of his kids had ever been to a zoo before, and I didn't really know what to expect. Lori said she thought zoos should be outlawed. Mom, who had Maureen in one arm and a sketch pad in the other, pointed out that the animals had traded freedom for security. She said that when she looked at them, she would pretend not to see the bars. At the entrance gate, Dad bought our tickets, muttering about the idiocy of paying money to look at animals, and led us down the walk. Most of the cages were patches of dirt surrounded by iron bars, with forlorn gorillas or restless bears or irritable monkeys or anxious gazelles huddled in the corners. A lot of the kids were having fun, gawking and laughing and throwing peanuts at the animals, but the sight of those poor creatures made my throat swell up. "I've got half a mind to sneak in here some night and free these critters," Dad said. "Can I help?" I asked. He mussed my hair. "Me and you, mountain goat," he said. "We'll carry out our own animal prison break." We stopped at a bridge. Below it, in a deep pit, alligators sunned themselves on rocks surrounding a pond. "The biddy who got that mountain lion shot didn't understand animal psychology," Dad said. "If you let them know you're not afraid, they'll leave you alone." Dad pointed to the biggest, scaliest alligator. Me and that nasty-looking bastard's gonna have us a staring contest. Dad stood on the bridge, glowering at the alligator. At first it seemed to be asleep, but then it blinked and looked up at Dad. Dad continued staring, his eyes in a fierce squint. After a minute, the alligator thrashed its tail, looked away, and slid into the water. "See? You just have to communicate your position," Dad said. "Maybe he would have gone for a swim anyway," Brian whispered. "What do you mean?" I asked. "Didn't you see how nervous that gator got? Dad made him do it." We followed Dad to the lion's den, but the lions were sleeping, so Dad said we should leave them alone. The aardvark was busy hoovering up ants, and Dad said you shouldn't disturb eating animals. So we passed it by and went on to the cheetah's cage, which was about as big as our living room and surrounded by a chain fence. The lone cheetah paced back and forth, the muscles in his shoulders shifting with each step. Dad folded his arms on his chest and studied the cheetah. "He's a good animal, fastest four-footed creature on the planet," he declared. "Not happy about being in this damned cage, but he's resigned to it, and he's no longer angry. Let's see if he's hungry." Dad took me to the concession stand. He told the lady running it that he had a rare medical condition and couldn't eat cooked meat, so he'd like to buy a raw hamburger. "Yeah, right," the sales clerk said. She told Dad the zoo didn't allow the sale of uncooked meat because foolish people try to feed it to the animals. "I'd like to feed her lard ass to the animals," Dad muttered. He bought me a bag of popcorn, and we returned to the cheetah cage. Dad squatted outside the fence opposite the cheetah. The animal came closer to the bars and studied him curiously. Dad kept looking at him, not in the angry-eyed way he had stared down the alligator. The cheetah looked back. Finally, he sat down. Dad stepped over the chain fence and knelt right next to the bars where the cheetah was sitting. The cheetah remained still, looking at Dad. Dad slowly raised his right hand and put it up against the cage. The cheetah looked at Dad's hand, but didn't move. Dad calmly put his hand between the iron bars of the cage and rested it on the cheetah's neck. The cheetah moved the side of his face against Dad's hand, as if asking to be petted. Dad gave the cheetah the kind of hearty, vigorous petting you'd give a big dog. "Situation under control," Dad said, and beckoned us over. We climbed under the chain fence and knelt around Dad while he petted the cheetah. By then, a few people had begun to gather. One man was calling to us to get back behind the chain fence. We ignored him. I knelt close to the cheetah. My heart was beating fast, but I wasn't scared, only excited. I could feel the cheetah's hot breath on my face. He looked right at me. His amber eyes were steady but sad, as if he knew he'd never see the plains of Africa again. "May I pet him, please?" I asked Dad. Dad took my hand and slowly guided it to the side of the cheetah's neck. It was soft, but also bristly. The cheetah turned his head and put his moist nose up against my hand. Then, his big pink tongue unfolded from his mouth, and he licked my hand. I gasped. Dad opened my hand and held my fingers back. The cheetah licked my palm, his tongue warm and rough like sandpaper dipped in hot water. I felt all tingly. "I think he likes me," I said. "He does," Dad said. "He also likes the popcorn salt and butter on your hand." There was a small crowd around the cage now, and one particularly frantic woman grabbed my shirt and tried to pull me over the chain. "It's all right," I told her. "My dad does stuff like this all the time." "He should be arrested," she shouted. "Okay, kids," Dad said. "The civilians are revolting. We better skedaddle." We climbed over the chain. When I looked back, the cheetah was following us along the side of the cage. Before we could make our way through the crowd, a heavy man in a navy blue uniform came running toward